From Lara Easy to In Conversation With podcast ahead of her performance on the 3rd of March at Jazz Cafe Posk. Hello, Lara. How are you?
Hello, Hannah. Good morning. I'm doing very well. And yourself?
I am good, thank you. Although I think you have better weather than me.
I'm not going to lie. Greece is very fortunate to have sun 24/7. I'm not going to lie there. It's a little cold, but yeah, it's lovely. We spoke about this earlier. That being born in a sunny country, and as you know, I used to live in the UK. I haven't ever felt more grateful to return to sun since I left. You know, that's how it goes with weather, I guess.
Yeah, I hate the winter.
You do, right?
And I often think, could I live somewhere which had all time sun and heat? And I think the answer is yes.
Yeah, we could switch places, Hannah. I don't mind at all. I really don't mind.
Because some people love the seasons, and I can understand that, but I don't think I necessarily do.
I know. Every time I used to travel over, because as you know, I used to be based in the UK for so long, and now that I'm relocated to Athens, every time I fly over to the UK, I actually, funnily enough, appreciate the cold, because I just think it's so inspiring in other ways for musicians. You know, it just gets, it's cold and it's depressing, and then, you know, you have all this music inside of you and you go back to a sunny country and it's so joyful. I don't know if this comes across as fair, but it's just, it's a different kind of thing, you know. I guess you have to appreciate where you are and, yeah, use the weather to your advantage, I guess.
Yeah, I can imagine coming back from what the weather is like here to somewhere lovely would inspire you to write happy music. Oh, it's just horrible here. Yeah. So you're in Athens at the moment.
Yes.
And when did you move back there?
So I was based in the UK. I did my master's there years ago at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama in jazz, and I stayed on. So I literally relocated to London in 2013. Going back and forth between countries to travel and gig and such. And then during COVID, remember those years we do not speak of, in 2020, April 2020, I took a tough, but I think well-warranted decision to return to Athens for two reasons, mostly. I realized that, you know, the music industry, as I'm sure you felt the same at the time, was just not great, and it was very unpredictable. And sure, we were all trying to, you know, find ways to make ends meet, but I just, something inside of me said that, okay, now is a good time to go home, at least temporarily. And that temporary feeling became 3 years. And I have to say, I very confidently now, in the last 2 months, I would say that I'm happy I took that decision. I was super doubtful before. Because, you know, I was building up such a nice sort of career there, and I still work with everyone there, all my music colleagues and, you know, fellow teachers and such. So what I've managed to do is just have Athens as a base and travel back to the UK for work. And recently I've been, you know, because as I said, I came during COVID and everything here was shut, and recently I've started to gig and do workshops here. So it's slowly feeling like it's coming around full circle, you know. It took a while, but I feel very grateful every time I get an opportunity to go back to the UK. It's a second home for me, really, and it doesn't feel like I have to navigate myself through the abyss, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a nice position to know. It's almost a bit like two homes, isn't it? They both feel safe and familiar.
Definitely. And I think this idea of home has often inspired my songs as of late, because as you know, we all have different projects going on. And whilst I was focusing a lot on the jazz stuff, I sort of took a step back and returned to my singer-songwriter roots, which I'm happy I did, because obviously, you know, you draw influences from everywhere. And a theme that kept recurring in my music was this, what you just said so wonderfully, this concept of home, and the idea that you can sort of pivot away from home, but then essentially you carry home wherever you are. And I think it, Does that make sense? And it keeps redefining itself through the music, through conversations. And it's a great thing to know that it's a lifelong thing, really. You could be based in Athens and you feel more at home in a club in Leeds, for instance, something strange like that. I guess I've always been fascinated by this idea of the familiar and the unknown at the same time and how they interplay with each other.
Have you got, thinking back to what happened to me this year, do you have any venues that you've played before, and when you return to them, they have that special feeling of, oh, I'm so glad I'm here again, even if there isn't a huge crowd or the weather's horrible or whatever, that it just has that special place in your heart. Have you got anywhere like that, either country?
That's a great question. In the UK,
Either country, I think, probably Athens
either.
or, yeah, or UK.
That's a great question. Well, I'll start with the UK. I love the 606. I've played there twice only, but it just feels like home. The staff is wonderful. The owner is great. Steve is just, he's a character of his own. He's wonderful. And I don't know. I just felt like walk. I the first time I played there, I remember when I entered and we were about to start sound check. I felt very welcome, like I'd entered this otherworldly, beautiful heaven of musicianship and people, if that makes sense. And it felt very much at home. And another venue which I really love is the Green Note, for similar reasons, really. And I remember the moment where I felt like, oh, when I finished the gig, and I didn't want to leave because it just felt like this was like a hangout, And it's funny how you can ha that I think it's to do with the atmosphere, but mostly the people running these venues, including bar staff and sound engineers and all those people. I can't stress this enough, and I think you would agree that they definitely influence how comfortable you feel entering a venue and how familiar it feels. In Athens, that's a really good question, Hannah. I have to say, Athens, unfortunately, although it's home, it does not have such a wide array of venues. It could very well have, they could easily turn their thousands of churches into venues. That's something I've always wondered why they didn't. But I think the venues that always felt like home to me weren't the bigger venues, the festival areas. It was mostly the small, tiny bars that are sort of cul-de-sacs in the Athenian streets downtown. And you enter, and again, it's a local place. People speak Greek, French, English. It's a very, very cosmopolitan vibe, but you can tell you're in Athens. It's very untouristy, funnily enough. And again, they're not typical venues. They're more like bars where the bar owners used to be musicians themselves. This is actually a trend in Athens, and they open up their space to musicians. And afterwards, there's always a jam session. And I think those venues are great. There's a venue called Spiti Bar, house bar translation. And yeah, that's my take on that.
Nice.
Yeah, I think so.
I like that idea that it's kind of an artistic person or a musician who takes on a restaurant or a bar and then opens up that space for others to enjoy. That's really kind of wholesome, isn't it?
It is, and I do believe that a lot of independently run venues, especially grassroots venues in the UK, sort of started on that notion, did they not? Where you had I can't remember any venues now, of course, at the top of my head, but I do believe there are some venues, especially in the north of the UK. Hyde Park Book Club, for instance, is one of them that comes to mind, where it was a genuine effort to bring together people from across the creative disciplines, in a bar and a book club, and then it turned into a venue. And yeah, it's definitely something wholesome about that, because I think the idea behind small venues is that, people, artists and venue owners themselves, they want to build a community. Otherwise, what's the point, really? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they like to share with others, which is also really nice.
Yeah, exactly. It's that idea of sharing. It's that idea of wanting people to build relationships within themselves, and also, and I'm sure you felt that at the start of your career, especially wanting to feel that the music you play, which is your own music, is welcome and it's appreciated, and not just playing to, people that will refuse to speak over very loud drinks and clap at the very end as if you performed, Rachmaninoff's, I don't know what symphony, you know what I mean, and you've had that those experiences. We've all had them, and they build character, and they're funny years later. But I think there's just something to be said about playing to an audience of five very attentive listeners, and then transitioning to a larger stage, and even there's nothing wrong with either, but I love the idea of playing to very intimate, small crowds, because I think you make such incredible connections, hopefully, when you play for them.
And does that influence how you write, thinking about an intimate audience that it's aimed at?
Do you mean after I've done a gig? How do you mean?
I mean, so if you're writing a new piece,
Mm-hmm.
do you think, oh, I'm writing this for like a handful of people when I'm performing it, or do you think of, oh, the whole world is gonna listen to this?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I really don't. I think, well, I never thought of it that way, actually. That's a great question. I think intuitively, I would say I imagine who the song is about, if it's about a person or if it's about a social topic. I imagine what I want one or a thousand people to feel. But what always ends up happening is that I find that the more personal the songs are, the more people can relate, whether it's a handful of people or, hundreds. And it's funny you should say that. I've had this discussion recently with fellow songwriters in the UK and in Greece, and we're always talking about, well, what constitutes a good song and who are you writing for? And I've always come down to the belief and drive that when you write something that's super personal to you, you're being authentic in your delivery. So whether you're playing at the Hampstead Jazz Club or an Athenian bar next to the Acropolis, it doesn't really matter. People are going to react because they can sense that you're pouring your life and soul into it. It sounds dramatic, but it's not really. You could compose a tutti sax line and you've narrated a completely different story as opposed to, the A and B sections, let's say, in a composition. Whereas in traditional songwriting, which has changed, as you know, if you're writing a verse, you need to be able to accentuate what you're saying with a chorus, if there even is one, which challenges the whole concept of what it means to write music and who you're writing it for. I don't know what you feel about the fact that, making music has changed so much in the last 10 years that I kind of feel very, I kind of want to take on more the role of an observer when I look at how people's creative processes have changed. Nowadays you could just waltz up in an airport mid-flight, whilst you're waiting for your flight, and then bring out your MIDI and then write something. Whereas back in the day, you had to be in front of a piano and you had to be with other musicians. So I think that also affects how I write music. I tend to favor the acoustic setting. I tend to favor finding a studio somewhere or having my guitar and writing on the spot and recording myself and then going to the studio and layering it. That's always been my favorite aspect. And to answer your question again, or rather to repeat what I've been saying, it's very important for me to know that the more personal the song is, then I've done my job, because I know that one person will be affected by it.
Yeah, I am also. I need to sit. Although I don't play piano, I sit at the piano to write because I generally do the chords first. So I need to be in front. I need to have my instruments with me to be able to write.
Yeah, and how is that process? Isn't it just completely unpredictable at times?
Yeah, you have no idea. I have no idea what will come out.
It And do you go in with an idea, or is it just random, or how does it? I'm really curious how that works for you too.
For me, I'm not a natural composer. I don't wake up and think I must write a piece, but I like playing the tunes that I write because they come from within me and they have a real strong connection with an emotion. So I sit and I write some, I get some chords, then I get a feeling and then it progresses and then I write the melody. So that's how it works for me. But it's definitely an emotion that a chord triggers and takes me on a journey within the piece. Whereas some people say, oh, I just wrote up and wrote, I woke up and I wrote a tune. I'm like, oh my goodness, how did you do that?
I know. I love that. I love that. I love the fact that, composers, and I think both composers and songwriters, and oftentimes these worlds are very, overlapping each other. I think you're right. You could be very lucky and wake up one day and have this entire beautiful piece in your head, and all you have to do is write it down or sing it or play it. And then at other times you work on a piece for months and you think it's great, and when you play it in front of an audience, you're like, oh, why didn't that work? So it's a balance, really. And I think for me, when I realized very quickly on that I wasn't just going to be a jazz singer, or I wasn't just going to be a session pop pianist, or what have you. And as I said, my first, I'm classically trained, and then I went into folk and pop, and jazz came a lot later. So the idea that I didn't want to be put in a box musically was very important to me, as it is to a lot of wonderful women creators such as yourself and everyone in the team, actually, Women in Jazz Media. I think for me it's important to note that the idea of crafting something from scratch, in my personal journey, has been, an amalgamation of all those influences, all those journeys that I took. I didn't think I would end up being a singer-songwriter. And I didn't think that I would have to write, actually, this is interesting, in my press releases, singer-songwriter slash jazz singer slash piano slash. And I remember having a conversation with Dave Bannington, who's the wonderful friend and bass player who's playing with me on Friday, next Friday. And I remember he saw me at one point struggling to write a press release, and he just said something so simple and it just blew my mind. He goes, "Well, why do you have to write all those slashes? Why do you just write singer songwriter? Let them guess, And it made me jubilant with joy, Hannah. I can't tell you. It was just that thing I needed to hear from someone else who, I have such respect for. And it just completely changed the way I approach writing, and I approach promoting myself, really. And every single interview I've had, I end up saying that I'm a singer-songwriter, when I know, and the person who's interviewing me knows, that there's so much more to that story. I just think that conversations like this are all about unraveling all those wonderful layers, and to see how an artist gets to where they're going. You know what I mean? It's a lifelong process, really, and I think that's incredible.
Yeah, and I think we're always striving to get better in these directions, which is what keeps it all moving forwards.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what you said is a very good point, actually, because we strive to get better, and I think it's not always going to be about improving, musically. It's about improving as a person, because, we're completely, I think musicians have that thing about them, which makes them musicians, that we're very emotional creatures. We need to connect with everything almost overwhelmingly at times. So music has become quite therapeutic for us, let alone the people who listen and support our music. You know what I mean? So I think it's a lifelong journey. And I think one thing that has been on my mind recently, and I love talking about this, as you very naturally segued into that. I think whenever we're going through things, it's beyond the idea of mental health for me. It's about our everyday struggles. It's because I think a lot of us have a lot of performance anxiety, or a lot of anxiety in general. And I think now that it's coming out that it's very accepted and there are resources to help us, I do think that part of our journey of becoming better is to just accept ourselves at whatever process we're at in our career, because it's about who we are as people before who we are as, you know, the artist on stage. And sometimes it's okay to separate those two things.
What you just said made me think of a few contacts I've had from people who I didn't know, who have got in touch and said, "Oh, your music has helped me with this." You know, because actually, quite often people go, "Oh, I really love your track," or whatever, don't they? But when someone says it's helped them, it kind of it makes you feel very kind of humble and privileged and like you're really pleased that you've touched their soul and it's been of benefit for them. Have you had any of those? Anybody get in touch about that?
Yes, and that's so lovely to hear that it's happened for you too. Yes, loads of times. And actually, I have to say that was one of the driving forces for me to choose music as a career, because before I went into music professionally, I had studied English literature in St. Andrews in Scotland. So again, artistic, but music was always around. And you know what it's like, you know, when music follows you around, you kind of have to surrender and say, okay, I'm gonna do music. And I remember when I was studying music as a teenager, and I started out as a classical pianist, and loved, I went into choirs, international choirs of Greece, etc. And I was always used to performing, and for me, I loved the stage, not so much because of the thrill of being on stage, which was, you know, wonderful anyway. I loved talking to people after every single performance and asking them genuinely, not what they thought of the music, but my question was always like, "How do you feel?" It's been so ingrained in my character as a kid, and you know, now well into my 30s, I have I'm very lucky, you know, and privileged to have that, and I feel humbled, like you said, because I think a lot of people who support my music or who don't know my music, actually more important, always tell me when they listen to me sing or when they download a track, as you said, they always say, "Thank you for being sincere in your message," or "Thank you, your music has helped me," or "The way you performed that night actually made me feel better." And what I'm getting at is, it's not always going to happen, but when it does, the feeling you have, I have, is just beyond anything. It's almost like you've really managed to achieve a very beautiful transcendental state of joy. I just can't describe it any other way, as I'm sure you can relate. And I think for me, especially now, my purpose in music as an artist and as an educator, which I have to stress, it's always been about healing. And again, I love performing. But I also love sharing what I do. I think that music was given to us from another worldly source. What that source is, I have no idea. But the reason why we love music, or I love music, is because I can see that it has that uncanny ability to just lift people. And I, in particular, in the last 7 years, Hannah, I've been really, really concentrating on providing workshops for people who have zero access to music, or non-musical people, or you know, people especially in with coming from a less privileged background, and they humble you because you could be playing a note, a drone, and asking people to improvise, and you've made their, not just their day, you've made their year. And it's not about you, it's not about me leading these sessions, it's about this collective energy of people needing to connect to something that can just express whatever's in their heart and soul. And you know, if that's not the power of music, I really don't know what is. So I think it's amazing that we have this ability to heal others and also heal ourselves. Because I'm sure you've been on stage where, and I certainly have been on stage where I've been going through very difficult times. And the minute I'm on stage, I just take a deep breath and I just surrender to the music. And I try not to control what happens. And at the end, you always feel better.
And maybe a bit cleansed. It's kind of worked its way out in a way.
Very, absolutely. It's so wonderful. It's a very, Yeah, it's a very cleansing mechanism. Recently, when I was in London in November, and I had had the honor of being one of the artists in residence for Hawkwood College of the Arts, and I remember I had made this plan, as you said, here comes the songwriting bit, to compose, a whole new album. And what ended up happening was that I wrote, for the first time in years, instrumental music. I actually didn't sing. I sung on the very last day, and because I went back to my piano roots, and it just happened. And that was part and parcel because of all the conversations I had with people in Hawkwood, from the people that would create, make food for all the residents, or the people running, or the other artists I bumped into. And I could see everyone's creative and emotional process as I did mine. And I remember going on daily walks, and I don't know if you've ever been in that side of the woods, Stroud. It's magical. The woods are just, for me, I mean, we don't really have much trees in Athens, so it was just very magical to cleanse my soul, but also to allow the music to come from that place of the unknown. And I remember having, I actually wrote a song for her because of that, having a conversation with a lovely woman. Who was gardening outside the studio room where I was playing. And when I exited the studio room, I was kind of in an emotional state. I was frustrated with the fact that in my mind, nothing sounded great, or it sounded like crap. And she just approached me and she said, "Thank you for accompanying the flowers." And I thought, wow, okay. And it just, everything just, my ego just bursted. And I thought, well, there you go. That's the power of music. You don't have to be perfect. You just need to be authentic. And we had such a wonderful conversation. And I wrote, one of the pieces I wrote was for her. So I'm excited to, after this album, my folk rock album, Sun, which is coming out, hopefully, if everything goes well, by the end of May, that's my next work, the odes to all these people I met during Hawkwood.
I was going to
Yeah.
say, do you have any plans for what's coming next?
Yes, thank you. I do. I am coming to London next week, and then right when I come back from London, after playing at Cafe Posk for Women in Jazz, I am going to go in what you know very well, lockdown mode with the album. I've assembled a wonderful team of incredible people here who are incredible musicians and a lifelong friend, my producer. And I've finished all the arrangements for the album. The album is called Sun, and I haven't recorded a full-length album in 8 years, so this is a big one for me. And I will actually be really excited to go into the studio, record it. I've got a string quartet, I've got wonderful rhythm section going, and then it hopefully should be finished and recorded by the end of April. And then I'm going to start the crowdfunding campaign to raise money to be able to actually mix and master and tour and produce CDs and vinyls. So it's very exciting. I haven't done this in such a long time, but now it feels right. And all those songs I've had that are in the album, some of them are very old that I've left abandoned, and I sort of revived them. And some of them are very, very new. So it's quite interesting to see those two sides of who I was and who I am now. And it's a risk, but it's a risk that I know I want to take, Yeah, and that's coming out soon, and I'm excited about it. And that's probably my biggest project to date, performance-wise and recording-wise. Yeah.
And I have to ask, is there any mandolin on it?
Yes.
Yay! I love the mandolin.
What made you ask about a mandolin? I'm curious. That's amazing.
Because I was listening to some of your music, and what's the one of the tracks? I wrote it down. What's it called?
Summer winds.
Yes, Summer Wind.
Ah.
And like I would say on the second head, but that's because I've got my jazz head on rather than
Yeah,
singing. But
yeah,
I just love it when the mandolin comes in. I love a mandolin. I don't know why. It just makes me, I don't know, it just makes me smile and feel a lot lighter. I don't know why. It's just the sound of it.
Oh, I'm with you there, 100%. Oh, that's a great story there. So, Dave, I call the honorary Greek, because I used to play with Dave and his wife Nadia Sharif, and now that I play a lot more with Dave, I kept saying to him, and every because we that song was recorded I did my bit here in Athens and he did his bit in the UK.
Yeah.
So, like most of our tracks, actually, like Phones, the first Greek track I sang actually with lyrics by Konstantin Kavafis, which we're going to play. And to make a long story short, I think it was very obvious that Dave's take on, what we know to be a lot deeper than what the name suggests, world music, let's say. We realized that, oh, a mandolin would suit there, and mandolin can come across as Irishy or Greek or whatever. And then when I wrote Summer Winds, which is quite folky, and filmed it in Athens, it couldn't be more Athenian, the setting. I messaged Dave and I said, hey, do you wanna play mandolin on this one? And of course he said yes. And he plays mandolin on a few other tracks we've composed together, actually, an accordion. So it's taken on a very folky feel, and I love that. And you're absolutely right. And you're not the first person to say, oh, that mandolin when it comes in. It's just sort of really nostalgic. And I'm excited about it because the album is going to include mandolin, a string quartet, and Irish bouzouki. So I'm really excited. Yeah. Very, yeah.
And what's what? Who, well, what instruments and who's playing with you at POSC?
Okay, so it's going to be yours truly.
Yep.
Singing and playing piano and acoustic guitar with effects. And then Dave, I'm going to be accompanied by Dave Mannington on bass, mandolin, and effects. And it's very exciting for me because this is probably the most stripped down acoustic set we've done, where it's going to be a whole mix of original material. Some of the material is actually going to be recorded later on. So I'm playing it for the first time to a London audience. And of course, because it's Women's Month in March and we're kicking it off nicely, I'm definitely in the set list. We've included beautiful hits by celebrated songwriters, like Stevie Nicks and Carole King and Joni Mitchell and Dan Reeves. So we've got a mix of folk and jazz inspired material. And it's going to be great. And it's very, very intimate. And I can't wait to see people there.
So just you and Dave?
Just me and Dave and a whole lot of heart. Yeah. Yeah.
Lovely.
Thank you.
So you fly in, will you get a little rehearsal with him before the day?
We will. We
Oh, good.
will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's another topic. Well, how to get people to rehearse when you're flying over. It's so spin. And we were talking about this before we started the podcast. What happens when you travel abroad and you don't know the musicians, and how do you organize rehearsals? And when you do, is one enough, etc. But I think, in this case with Dave, we've been playing together for so long that, the rehearsal is just there to assert, to basically to put us in the same room, Yeah, and I think rehearsals have always been a fan of when it comes to creating a project from scratch. After that, I think one is sometimes more than enough. But I know that in the UK, I don't know if you'll agree, the idea of rehearsing is sometimes not really favored. People kind of just want to do stuff in the sound check and go to the gig. I don't know if you agree.
Yeah, I come across that lots if I'm asked to play for someone else, but I definitely, before we recorded the album, before we launched it, we had a day's rehearsal, because new ideas come up. And actually, as you say, it's not necessarily need rehearsal, but you're catching up with your friends who are colleagues who are humans, and all sorts of things come out of that as well. Like, we've got some great stories that have come out of that. And but I am a big, I do like, I hate a rushed sound check. I'd rather sound check is really for you to check your sound, check you're comfortable on stage. It's not to learn a new tune, decide a new idea. And that's, I don't really work in that way. I like to, because I can tend to do like a set show. I've written a new show for this year, so we've already done that work. So if we didn't have a sound check, we could rock up and play it. It would be fine. But it's nice to have a sound check, because then you feel better on stage because you can hear everyone. That's the whole point of it, isn't it? The balance front and back.
Exactly. And yeah, I'm exactly like you. And I think that You know, sometimes, well, it's different. I guess it's also different for the types of music you're doing sometimes. Like if you're playing a sort of very standardy jazz sets, yeah, you don't really need a rehearsal. You need to top and tail things, as we know, hopefully. And then, but of course, when you've got complicated arrangements, or when you want to have specific ideas, and it's sometimes easier to actually just vocalize those ideas in person, I find that having a rehearsal or two at most is always helpful. And it just, like you said, it's about seeing your friends, being in the same room, relaxing into the music, and then by the time sound check comes up, you're all good and you just want to play. And yeah. And I think for me, I don't know about you, but at every single gig I've ever had, the waiting time between sound check and when you're about to start has always been like, I'm always constantly looking at my watch. I don't know how you are. I just think that's funny because you're kind of like, okay, let's do it now. I'm ready, you know? I
Yeah.
don't know.
I think that in a sound check, you're aware that you need to be done by a certain time.
Yeah.
So I if I can, I'm one of those people, I'll try and be done 10 minutes early so no one's stressed out. Like the door guys can be like, we're done, don't worry. Because people do run on, don't they? And then it puts everybody under pressure. And I'd rather everybody was quite relaxed and it was all as smooth as it could be. I like.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I just
No,
try to do that.
I'm really looking forward to it, I haven't been to London in since my Green Note gig and my residency in November, so I'm really looking forward to it. And I'm only there for 4 days, but I'm looking forward to catching up with people and, reconnecting in a way. So it'll be great.
Yeah, definitely. So, do you have any funny stories about anything that's happened to you on stage?
Oh, where to start? Funny stories. Oh gosh. Okay, now that I said I have loads, my mind just went blank. Typical. So, I'm trying to think of one. Yes, at the Green Note, actually. So, I love stage banter, as you can tell. And sometimes I get so carried away with stage banter, I forget that I end up sounding like a massive chatterbox, which isn't bad, it's very entertaining most of the time. Well, it's in my head at least. No, I'm joking, people laugh. And what's really funny is that my music is quite opposite to how I am as a person. It's very melancholy, most of it. I mean, I do write some happy music, as you said, but most of my music is very. It's very contrasting to how cheerful I am in my banter. Anyway, to make a long story short, we were doing the Green Note gig, and I don't know why I started to talk about the reason why I wrote a particular song. I think it was Forgive. And forgives, as the title suggests, about taking the high road and forgiving people. And I went into this 5 minute monologue, I want to call it that, about how it's very difficult to forgive because times are shit, people are shit, and I just started going off on how shitty people and situations can be. Don't ask why, it just happened. And then I saw people start to laugh, and then they laughed harder and louder and louder. And then at the end, I just felt Dave's hand on my shoulder going, okay, wrap it up, Lara. It was just the kind of, and I was saying, like, yeah, you all think that you can take the high road and forgive, but it's really hard, man. And I just went off and on and on. And then Dave's hand is like, it's okay, Lara. We can play the song. I don't know why that happened, but it was just, well, anyway, one of those moments where I got carried away with speech rather than singing. And yeah, it was just funny. And the sound engineer was like taping me as I was going off on a rant. But yeah, there have been funnier stories, like how I nearly blew the sound system at a venue because I forgot to unplug my guitar when they told me to. And typical things. And the next time I played that venue, they actually taped Lara proof to the wires to make sure I wouldn't trip over them or cause any harm. So, I'm telling you, Hannah, we need to go out for pints. I have loads of stories. Yeah, I'm gonna stop there.
I love these stories. So we're coming to the end of chatting, which has been really, really lovely. Thank you for taking the time to come on the
Thank you.
podcast, and I hope it goes well on the 3rd of March, not long to go.
Thank you.
I
Thank
have
you.
two Hannah questions for you.
Okay.
Yeah. The first one is, do you know what a desert island disc is? Do you know that radio show?
Yes, of
Okay.
course.
What is your desert island disc and why?
Oh gosh. You're gonna not like my answer. All of them? I know I've answered the same question like that before. All of them, because every single album, I can't even name one in particular. That whole, it's just such a concept thing for me. It's very difficult to pin down. So I'm gonna be annoying and say all of them. All of this. I'm sorry, Hannah.
Okay, and the last question of mine is, what's your favorite time signature?
My favorite time signature, two time signatures. I love 7/8, and I love 5/4 when it's done in a relaxed way.
So 7/8, how would you divide it?
Gosh, so 7/8 for Greek musicians is slightly different because of the pulse. So I'm just gonna step back from the microphone. So it's like. That's how we feel 7/8. Although when Western idea, musicianship, a lot of people count it as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. They're kind of like
Oh,
this.
okay.
It's different. So there's a particular song that actually is perfect for a 7/8. I'll just hum it slightly. So it goes dun, 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 dun. The subdivision, you can hear all the sevenths. So, so what happens to 7/8 is that you start to shift in the five. So 7/8, I love. 5/4, I've only played very rarely and mostly in jazz compositions. But I would actually, if I can, I'll retract the 5/4, and I would say, I actually love 2/4 because it's not 4/4. It's because it's a whole different, but you know what I mean. It's a whole different vibe. And one particular piece comes to mind, Vince Mendoza's Esperanza, where it starts out in 2/2, and then it goes to 2/4, and then it goes to 4/4, and then really it's in 2/2, as you know. And it's just the idea of pushing the groove and going under the groove that always excited me, because the way you lay down your vocals and lyrics can it's a lot harder with 2/2, and I'm always up for a challenge. So those are my favorite time signatures.
Good
Yes.
answers.
Oh,
And I enjoyed the demonstration.
yes, sorry. I hope that comes across okay in the audio.
Yeah, me too. It's great. Love that.
Thank you.
So thank you so much again for coming on today. And I'm sure it will go amazingly well next week on the 3rd of March at Jazz Cafe Posk.
Thank you, Hannah. It was very lovely to be here, and I look forward to meeting you and seeing everyone at Cafe Posk.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this podcast for women in jazz media. We have a great back catalogue of podcasts with amazing women, including Claire Martin, OBE, Tatiana Gorolovsky, Colette Cooper, and many more. Please do check them out, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye.